In his book Storm Kings, America's First Tornado Chasers, Lee Sandlin gives us an American history of storm chasing. He says when settlers first encountered tornadoes, they had no idea what they were seeing.
So when you talk about the beginnings of tornado chasing, you're really talking about a guy on horseback riding alongside this small funnel.
This hour on Focus, I'll talk with Sandlin about our first encounters with tornadoes and about the scientists who made it a mission to understand them. Then, I'll talk with Jeffrey Frame, an atmospheric scientist who has been chasing tornadoes since 2004. As a scientist, he says there's something majestic about severe weather. As a storm chaser, he says he's seduced by the adrenaline.
We turned off on a side road, came over this hill, and there's this big cone tornado sitting there probably 4 or 5 miles away. And we had no idea it was there.
I'm Lindsay Moon. That's coming up on Focus after this news. Good morning. Welcome to Focus. I'm Lindsay Moon. A tornado is a violently rotating column of air that comes in contact with the ground. They've been seen on every continent except Antarctica, and their severity is measured on a scale of 1 to 5. I looked that up on Google. It was pretty easy information to find. After reading Lee Sandlin's book Storm Kings, America's First Tornado Chasers, I feel lucky to be able to have easy access to that information. When American settlers first encountered tornadoes, they were both intrigued and horrified by the storms, and they had no idea what they were. Lee Sandlin writes in his book Storm Kings that it was early Americans who started moving to the Midwest and became interested in tornadoes, storm prediction, and the causes of severe winds on the prairie. Lee Sandlin joins me now to talk about tornadoes and our history with them. Storm Kings is now out in paperback. Lee, welcome to Focus.
Pleasure to be here.
So I want to start out at the very beginning. Ben Franklin plays a role in this story like he does in many to do with beginnings of research about science. Can you tell me about how he contributed to early research about tornadoes?
He was important for two reasons. One for a purely scientific reason, which is he was the first person to try and theorize how tornadoes over land worked. People knew about water spouts. Sailors had seen them, travelers in the tropics had seen them, but whether there were similar forms over land was, when he was writing, still kind of a matter of rumor. So he was extremely important for the first scientific search for tornadoes, but he was also, in a strange way, the first tornado chaser. I found in his correspondence a letter where he described seeing a small tornado form while he and some of his friends were riding through the countryside in Maryland, and he rode after it on horseback. So when you talk about the beginnings of tornado chasing, you're really talking about a guy on horseback riding alongside this small funnel. In fact, in his letter, he claimed that he was trying to lash at the funnel with his riding crop to see if he could get the funnel to break up. I don't know whether that actually happened or not, but it's a really good image.
It was around the time where Ben Franklin was looking into if these water spouts existed on land that we get the word tornado when it started being used. Where does that word come from?
Well, tornado is actually an older word, which is really sort of odd. They had the word before they had something to apply it to. Tornado is a word that shows up in England in English in the beginning of the 17th century as a term for a storm at sea. It did not mean at that point what we think of as a tornado. It appears to have meant to the sailors to have been a term for winds arriving from contrary directions. And in fact, the odd thing is that Franklin in one of his letters said that he called what he was looking for land spouts, by an analogy with water spouts. And he said, I'm specifically not talking about tornadoes, because he thought tornadoes then meant this kind of, you know, little whirlwind at sea and not what we would think of now. So the term kind of floated around. And in fact, one of the peculiar things about doing research on the subject is that it wasn't really until the middle of the 19th century that the term got properly fixed to what we think of as tornadoes. They used all kinds of words to describe what we would call tornadoes. They called them hurricanes. They called them gales. They called them just windstorms. So when you're reading, researching this and looking through early records of weather, sometimes very hard to know what they were talking about.
I think it's interesting you mentioned that tornado was an early word to describe the direction of winds. As we get a little bit further along in this progression of what we know about tornadoes, there was lots of controversy about how the winds moved and how that created a tornado. Can you tell me about that?
Yeah, during the early 19th century, there was a violent feud I don't know whether it's violence in the sense of fisticuffs, but an impassioned feud between two of the leading scientists on weather in America over the nature of what the wind did in a tornado. The leading expert thought that the surrounding air was drawn into a tornado and went straight up without rotating, and his opponent thought the tornado rotated, but the air didn't rise. So they were each partially right and partially wrong, and their fight was so impassioned that it divided up the entire scientific community in America. It was sometimes said to have paralyzed American meteorology for the better part of a generation.
The two folks that you mentioned got involved, that was coined the Storm War.
Yeah.
After many years. James Espy and William Redford were the two scientists that you talk about. And James Espy really does play a large role in beginning meteorology in the United States.
Yeah, he was a brilliant man. He was the first person to really understand the nature of convection, which is a core scientific principle in meteorology. You can't understand the action of the atmosphere without it. So in that sense alone, he should be remembered. But on the other hand, he was also a man who, well, there's a lot of other precedents among scientists for this, but he simply had no interest in listening to people who disagreed with him. So in the case of tornadoes, he had the key insight as to what they were, which was the rising column of air, but he simply refused to believe they could rotate. In fact, when people would say, "I saw it, and I saw the wind spinning," he would just flat out tell them that they were wrong.
So when did we come to the agreement that tornadoes do actually rotate, and the fact that the winds are moving in a rotation is a core defining principle for what a tornado is?
Well, what essentially happened is that as the studies went on, more and more direct observations of tornadoes began to accumulate. There was a tornado that passed over Philadelphia, actually, around the middle of the 19th century, and a large group of scientists and other people interested in the weather watched it happening from the roof of the university, and they clearly saw that the funnel was rising and was also rotating. And so if things like that finally became, it became inescapable as to what the nature of a tornado was. There was a man named William Farrell, who actually was the first person to work out the physics of it. His theory was actually wrong, but it was right enough so that it was able to spark a sudden resurgence of research on tornadoes. So that was really where we began to get the modern understanding of tornadoes. It was really the second half of the 19th century.
So when William Farrell enters the picture, there's been this lull in research into tornadoes, in part because of the Civil War.
Yes.
And so after the Civil War, when a lot of people started to homestead and move to the American Midwest on the prairie, is when there was a lot of attention again being paid to tornadoes. When settlers got to the Midwest, what did the Native Americans tell them about these storms?
Well, it's interesting because at the time when the Native Americans were willing to give advice to the settlers, that wasn't an extended period when they were willing to do it, but there was a while before they really realized what the settlers were up to.
Right.
When they were willing to give advice, they told, they passed on a lot of practical knowledge of tornadoes, but they also passed along a lot of really horrible advice. They told the settlers to build their villages at the junction of rivers because they said tornadoes can't cross water, which is completely false, but is sort of the beginning of bad tornado advice, which is something that continues through to this day.
Was there any information that they were given that was useful?
Well, you know, one of the practical things that the Native Americans knew, which was that the best way to take shelter from the tornado when you were in the open country was to get as close to the ground as possible, and if preferably into a ditch or a depression in the ground. That still is actually the best way to survive a tornado in the open country. People have this idea that they should make for things like freeway overpasses, but those are horrible places to try and ride out a tornado. The best thing is to get out of your car and look for depression or some kind of shallow depression on the ground and lie flat.
I think it's interesting that we talk about misinformation and information about tornadoes. In your book, you also write about when some of the settlers were moving to the plains, they became quickly annoyed at some of these storms because when they moved, they hadn't really been informed that this was a thing that you were going to have to
Yeah,
be
nobody
aware.
Knew anything about them, actually.
Yeah.
They were quite surprised when they saw them. And more than annoyed. And the other problem was that the National Weather Service did not have a great policy about tornado information in those days. They actually tried to avoid talking about tornadoes, in part because they were being pressured by the government and the real estate interests not to talk about tornadoes because they didn't want to discourage people from buying land in the prairie.
And this is in the mid to late 1800s.
Yeah, although the ban on mentioning tornadoes began then, but it actually lasted until after World War II. The National Weather Service never predicted tornadoes in those years, and in fact, for a lot of those years, collected no information on tornadoes at all.
The Signal Corps was one of the groups that was actively collecting reports about tornadoes. When were they active in collecting those, and what started the federal government's interest in trying to forecast tornadoes?
Well, there was always a sense even going back to the early days of the Republic, that people would find weather information valuable. But it wasn't until the arrival of the telegraph system, which began in the 1850s in a serious way. They had it earlier, but it became more of a national network starting in the 1850s, that it became practical to get real-time weather information. And the Smithsonian Institution began collecting weather data and making forecasts. And the Signal Corps took that over after the Civil War. And the Smithsonian got out of the weather business for a variety of reasons, and the Signal Corps was essentially looking for a new job after the war was over for the peacetime occupation, and they became de facto the National Weather Service, the first wave of it. And so they were collecting information, and they had the networks of telegraphs around the country already. They began collecting massive amounts of data. And as they began collecting it, they began collecting information on violent weather. And, of course, in the Midwest, tornadoes are a frequent occurrence. On the East Coast, they're really pretty unusual. And so in the 1870s, really, was when they began systematically trying to figure out how bad tornadoes were and what might cause them. So that's when you really find the beginnings of systematic study of tornadoes. And that lasted until around the end of the 19th century.
When some of that early research started to be done and there were people out talking about tornadoes and trying to figure out what caused them, what were some of the early theories?
Well, you know, they had all kinds of... They had a basic model for tornadoes which wasn't, in fact, wrong, that was worked out by meteorologists like Espy and Redfield that we were talking about. They understood in principle the basic mechanism of tornadoes, that it was the clashing of two air masses, hot air from hot humid air coming up from the Gulf of Mexico and cold dry air coming from Canada. So they didn't have a specific mechanism worked out. They thought they had a lot of ideas, some of which, and this is an interesting thing, some of the ideas they had, even though they had no scientific basis, persisted for the better part of a century. When I was a kid, I heard that tornadoes are so destructive because there's a vacuum at the core of the funnel, and as it passes over a house, the pressure inside the house pushes outward into the vacuum and causes the house to explode. When I was a kid, I was told, people were told in school, the thing you were supposed to do was open up the windows of the house to equalize the air pressure. Now, this is completely false and is, in fact, incredibly dangerous to do, to waste time when you should be taking shelter, opening up windows. But that was the best advice they had in the 1960s, and that theory actually originated in the 1870s and had never been tested, and it had never been rejected. So when I was talking about bad advice before, that's one of the examples of it, where an idea that was just a speculative notion in the 1870s persisted until quite recently.
In the course of your research, is there one piece of misinformation that you are most shocked by?
I'll tell you something. I just didn't get into the book because it just happened last spring, but when the Moore, Oklahoma tornado, which you may remember, when there was an extremely destructive tornado, And the local weather people were telling people to get in their cars and drive away from it. A car is a catastrophically bad place to try and ride out a tornado. And it really stunned me that people would be on television giving advice that really just ignorant and irresponsible. And so it surprises me really at how little anything has changed. It also surprises me quite a lot that, and I've discovered this traveling around the Midwest when I've been talking to people about tornadoes for this book, is that the Midwest is getting hugely overbuilt, and the new construction, no one is taking the trouble to include any kind of storm shelter. And so it feels like we're going backwards in tornado preparedness.
I think that's interesting that there's this vein of misinformation, because there's also this vein throughout the history of this research that people are really interested and then they stop caring for a period of time and then someone comes along and picks it back up.
Yeah.
And that's when we get reinvested. I mean, since we've been talking about this in the modern era between like the 60s and today, has there been that ebb and flow of research and interest?
Well, there's been a huge spike of interest in tornadoes in the last couple of decades, and a huge number of genuine advances in tornado studies, and that can be traced to one factor specifically, and that's the advent of the video camera. Because for the first time, we have a very large library of tornado images. Because this is one thing people have easy to forget now, because you can go on YouTube and you can spend hours watching tornadoes. They actually call this, there's a whole genre of this stuff they call torn porn. And that's very new. When I was a kid, it was an extremely rare event for somebody even to have a clear photograph of a tornado. They were completely mysterious. And now that we've got this, they're not as mysterious now because we've got visual records of them, so a lot of the original ideas about tornadoes have been discarded. And that's been led to a huge spike in the study of tornadoes.
I want to revisit when we were talking about settlers out on the prairie,
yeah,
first encountering these tornadoes. I was really fascinated by the description in the book you give of wind roads in settlers moving out and encountering these big patches of prairie where the grass was gone.
Yeah, and in forests, too. These long, long trails through forests where all the trees had been down.
Before people knew that those storms were the reasons for that, what were some of the theories as to why those existed?
Well, everybody had the sense that it was clearly something caused by the wind, which is why they got the name Wind Road. But what specifically caused it, people found completely mysterious. This is where in fact I got the title from the book, is that there was a sort of folklore creature called the Storm King that they thought, they didn't take this seriously, but you find poems where people wrote about the Storm King was riding through the forest and it was, you know, his giant horse that tore through the trees that left the trail down. So I think that was really, this is a thing that people had the sense that the American landscape was very mysterious. And it took a lot of concerted, well, it still is actually quite mysterious. There's a lot about tornadoes that people still don't know. When you look back at those times, that's when you find the beginning of this sort of mystery and the sense that there was something there to be solved.
You also write about some of the early tales of storms that were collected. There was always someone in a town that a tornado had been struck by that just never really quite got over what had happened.
Yeah, today we call that post-traumatic stress disorder, but they knew all about it in the 19th century, even though they didn't have a word for it.
Do the things that people are surprised by and horrified by about tornadoes remain consistent over the years?
Yeah, I think so, because the thing about a tornado, unless you actually see it firsthand, is the astonishing level of destruction and how fast it happens. And that is something that people were quite stunned by when they first came to the Midwest, and is still really can be quite shocking when you see it firsthand, is just the sheer destructive power of the tornado, and you know, this kind of extraordinary violence in a very small space. That remains really the the thing that lasts about tornadoes in people's minds.
I was really surprised to find out that we didn't really take tornado predictions seriously until after 1950.
Yeah, yeah. Well, the theory among the people in the National Weather Service was that since it was impossible to predict a tornado's path exactly, that a bad forecast was worse than no forecast at all. And, you know, this is true. Tornado prediction is still very much, and I'm not sure quite what the word is here, it's not, there really isn't such a thing as a tornado prediction now, even now. You can predict the likely conditions for a tornado, but the possibility of saying that particular storm cell is going to spawn a tornado in the next 6 hours is really still not true. We still can't do that. So a prediction really now involves a tornado being on the ground and predicting where it might go, as opposed to predicting that a storm is going to form at a certain point.
The Signal Corps were the first ones who really started a weather alert system with a set of flags. There's still confusion today as it exists between the difference between a warning and a watch. How did the weather forecasting alerts develop?
Well, it came out of this problem I'm talking about, which is the difficulty of making a specific prediction. The idea originally was that if you knew that there were the general conditions existed where a tornado was likely to form, you would call that a watch area. And while I've been talking about how people have had little progress, it should be pointed out that those watch areas are actually extremely well done now. It's very, very rare for a tornado to occur outside of the watch area. So you had the watches, which said the conditions are there where a tornado could form. And then you had the warnings, which meant a tornado was actually on the ground. And people are confused by it, and I know that there are a number of meteorologists now who say we really got to get rid of the system and come up with something else that people can really understand, because one of the problems that always happens when there's a tornado is a huge amount of confusion, and which often can lead to fatalities.
I guess when I first saw the title of the book, America's First Tornado Chasers, I expected a lot more about people actually getting out in a car and driving after a tornado with a video camera.
Yeah.
That does not come until much later in this story.
Yeah.
When were those first storm chasers out looking at tornadoes?
Well, it started as soon as they had some kind of sense of being able to do it and being able to record it. So that when home movies started in the 1950s and a little later in the 1960s, people were going out with cameras to film violent storms. So that was really the beginnings of it. The key breakthrough was the introduction of Doppler radar, which happened in the 1970s when it really became widespread, because that was the first time you could use radar to track a tornado on the ground. And that was really the first time when people were going out hunting tornadoes, where they would be able to know where to look specifically.
Walking away from the process of writing this book and going around and talking with people in the Midwest, what are some of the misconceptions that still exist that you think are the most glaring when it comes to our understanding of tornadoes?
Well, people do have this idea, as I said, mentioned earlier, that the best place to hide from a tornado in the open country is under a freeway overpass. I want to stress to listeners, it's a horrible place to hide because a freeway overpass can act like a wind tunnel. So the wind can actually speed up as it's passing under the bridge. So you've seen videos of people hiding there. The people who survived it were extraordinarily lucky. So that's one thing. The other thing that I keep on hearing from people are things like hide in the southwest corner of the basement. This is something that was advice that was around there again from the 19th century. I heard it when I was a kid. It doesn't really matter what corner of the basement is. One of the things that is little known about tornado fatalities that has been discovered in the last several years is that almost all the deaths caused by tornadoes are caused by flying debris. And so the best possible thing you can do if a tornado is imminent is to take shelter somewhere where there are no windows. You want to protect yourself from flying debris. That's the crucial thing to remember if you're faced with a tornado.
When you finished the research for the book, you mentioned that there were still things that we don't know about tornadoes.
Yeah.
What were some of the questions that you have been left with?
Well, as I said, the key thing is, this is a phenomenon that's called tornadogenesis, which is what the exact trigger mechanism is that causes a tornado to form. And people are really surprised to hear, we still don't really know what that is. And it's not just that we don't know, we may never really know. Now, I say that, and I want to stress that tomorrow, a researcher at the National Severe Storms Laboratory could say, oh, no, we figured it out. But it's also, I talked to tornado people who said, we may never get to the point where we know exactly where the tornado is going to form and exactly why.
Lee, thank you very much for taking a few minutes to talk with me about Storm Kings today.
Oh, it's been my pleasure.
I'm Lindsay Moon, sitting in for Jim Meadows, and today on Focus, I've been talking with Lee Sandlin about his book, Storm Kings, America's First Tornado Chasers. We're going to take a short break, but when we come back, I'll talk with Jeffrey Frame, Clinical Assistant Professor of Atmospheric Sciences at the University of Illinois. He is a storm chaser. Stay with us. You're listening to Focus on WILL AM 580. Welcome back to Focus. I'm Lindsay Moon, in for Jim Meadows. So far this hour, we've been talking about tornadoes and how we know what we do about why they happen. Before the break, I was talking with Lee Sandlin, author of the book Storm Kings, America's First Tornado Chasers. Jeffrey Frame, Clinical Assistant Professor of Atmospheric Sciences at the University of Illinois, who is a storm chaser, joins me now. He's been chasing severe storms and tornadoes since 2004. Jeff, welcome to Focus.
Hi, Lindsay. Thanks for having me on.
Thanks for being here today. So, earlier in the hour, we were talking about tornadoes and a lot about how we know what we know about them. So I guess a good place to start might be, can you tell me meteorologically, what is a tornado and why do they happen?
Yeah, absolutely. A tornado is defined as a violently rotating column of air in contact with the ground pendant from a cumulonimbus cloud. Now, what does that mean in English? Well, it means a tornado, we have air spinning around or rotating very fast. I think most of you probably knew that. But these rotating columns of air must descend from cumulonimbus clouds or thunderstorm clouds, or informally, we call them thunderheads. And it's important to note that the tornado is the rotating wind itself. It's not the funnel cloud that you might think of when somebody says tornado. It's the rotating winds that actually pose the danger, not the cloud itself.
How many tornadoes do we usually get that touch down and can be defined as a tornado each year in Illinois?
Illinois sees on average of 35 tornadoes each year. Now, some year, that's a long-term average, of course, so some years might be a little more active than that, and some years might be a little bit more quiet than that.
And we get more tornadoes than some other places, but less than certain other states like Ohio, for example.
Right. For example, tornadoes are most common in what we call Tornado Alley that runs from roughly from Nebraska down south to Texas, from eastern Colorado, usually east into Missouri. There's another maximum in tornado occurrence across the southeastern U.S., Arkansas, Mississippi, Alabama, places like that, and that's taken the informal name Dixie Alley over the past couple of years. Places like the East Coast and especially the West Coast, California, Oregon, and Washington, tornadoes there are fairly uncommon, but they're not unheard of. Actually, last Friday night, there was a tornado near Sacramento, California.
Why does the Midwest and some of those places get more tornadoes than other places in the country?
Really, the answer goes back to geography. And you think about, what are the ingredients you need for a tornado? The number one thing you need is warm, moist air at the surface. And that warm, moist air acts as fuel for thunderstorms. You can't have a tornado without a thunderstorm. This amount of instability, we call it, or this energy that builds up in the atmosphere, we get these layers of air coming east off the Rocky Mountains, and the temperature in those layers of air decrease very rapidly with height. And that allows the instability to really build up in the atmosphere to some pretty high levels. You could think of it like putting a tea kettle on the stove, and you can have a gradual release of that energy. But now, don't try this at home, but if you were to take a cork and put it in the spout of that tea kettle, eventually you'd get an explosive release of energy. Okay. The second ingredient we need is what's called vertical wind shear, and that's a change in wind speed or wind direction with height. And when a thunderstorm forms in that environment, it's able to tilt the horizontal rotation. Imagine a rolling pin or something rotating around a horizontal axis, and it can tilt that into the vertical. So the entire thunderstorm cloud starts rotating. And these are called supercell thunderstorms. If you were to look at them on radar, they don't look like hurricanes like some of you might think, but they have a distinctive hook-shaped echo, usually on their southwest corner. The third ingredient we need for thunderstorms and tornadoes is some kind of trigger to make the air go up. And that can be something like a cold front. It could be something like a leftover boundary of cold air left over from the previous day's storms. Or something called the dry line, which is common from Kansas through Oklahoma and Texas, where you get a confluence of warm, moist air from the Gulf of Mexico and hot, dry air coming together from the desert southwest. The old myth that warm air plus cold air equals tornadoes is just that. It's a myth. If that were true, we would have seen a big tornado outbreak last Sunday, and we certainly didn't when temperatures dropped 50 to 60 degrees in 24 hours across parts of Texas and other parts of the country.
I think it's interesting that you mentioned that cold air plus warm air doesn't equal a tornado. That is what I thought for a really long time. Earlier in the hour, I was talking with Lee Sandlin about misconceptions about tornadoes.
Right.
What is the one that you are encountered with most often as a meteorologist?
Well, we hear that one a lot. Folks writing sometimes in the media will say, well, why was there a big tornado outbreak? And it's, you know, warm air plus cold air equals tornadoes. Well, when warm air and cold air meet, you get fronts, cold fronts, warm fronts, and those can be triggers for air to rise in the atmosphere. For example, last November 17th, when we had that big tornado outbreak here in Illinois, that was triggered by a cold front. But that's not always the case. Dry lines, where warm air meets warm air, can also trigger tornadoes.
As we're talking about this, I wish everyone could see you because you look really excited. We're talking
about, I am.
You're very passionate about tornadoes. You chase storms yourself. What fascinates you about tornadoes?
When I go out and chase storms, I'm not just in it for the tornado. It's kind of a double-edged sword. You get an adrenaline rush looking at a tornado and looking at the power of nature as long as you do it from a safe distance. I'm not one of these extreme chasers you might hear about going right up to a tornado or certainly going into a tornado. That's incredibly, incredibly dangerous. So you're able to witness the majesty and the beauty of nature and the majesty and the beauty of the atmosphere, which I understand at a fairly fundamental level down to the mathematical equations that govern it. But even if you don't see a tornado, these rotating storms called supercells can be absolutely majestic because the entire cloud rotates. And usually when you see, for example, online videos of this, it's a time-lapse video, so it's sped up a little bit. But sometimes the cloud will look like a stack of dinner plates, or in some extreme events like a UFO or a flying saucer up there in the atmosphere, only it's not aliens, it's the storm itself.
You mentioned a couple different things that storms look like. Mm-hmm. Do all storms look the same?
No. Storms are kind of like people in a way, in that two people's faces never look the same, except for twins. Two storms never look the same. And when I go online and I browse pictures of storms, or when I see pictures of storms on television, if I've seen that storm, I can almost instantly recognize it. You go out and you look at these storms, and sometimes you can look at a single storm for a period of 5 hours if it persists, if it's isolated, if it's slow moving.
I talked with Lee about the fact that a lot changed about what we know about storms when we could take pictures of them, so we could spend more time looking at them. When you look at a photo of a storm, mm-hmm. what are you looking for? There were a few photos this morning in the News Gazette of the tornadoes in Gifford. And to
right.
me, it just, like, one of them looks like it's raining. The other one looks like there might be a little bit more rain and there's a cloud. And then all of a sudden there's a tornado and I just don't really know what I'm looking at. So what do you look for?
Right. If you're looking for a storm to produce a tornado, the first thing you want to look for is a supercell thunderstorm. That's one of those storms, the entire cloud or the entire plume of rising air that feeds the storm. We call that an updraft. The entire thing rotates. And you can look for the hook-shaped signature on radar, which tells you you have a supercell. You can look for rotation on radar. Hey, we have a supercell. But if that supercell is to produce a tornado, the one thing you want to look for is low-level rotation at cloud base. And often, in most tornadoes, form from what are called wall clouds. And what a wall cloud is it's a lowered cloud down beneath the cloud base. Now, sometimes wall clouds rotate and sometimes they don't. If the wall cloud isn't rotating, there probably isn't any imminent danger from a tornado. But if a wall cloud is rotating, and especially if it's rotating rapidly, a tornado can form at any time. And tornadoes can evolve really, really fast. We have research radars that go out and can scan the storm every 2 minutes. Even even then we would say, hey, you know, there's a lot going on here in these 2 minutes. Sometimes tornadoes can form within a minute, and that's what happened in Gifford. The atmosphere back on November 17th was that favorable for tornadoes to form. Now, it's important, too, another misconception. You can't tell the strength of a tornado just by looking at it. I know they do that in Twister, in the movie that came out back in the 90s, all the time. It's a fun movie to watch. Believe me, I love watching that movie, but there are a lot of things scientifically wrong with it. So if you think that's what storm chasing's like, it's a little bit different than that.
So what is it really like?
The number one thing, it's a lot of driving. When I go out on two-week trips, we generally average between 5,000 and 6,000 miles of driving in 2 weeks.
Oh, wow.
Our record was in May of 2012. We actually put in 7,300 miles in 2 weeks. Now, obviously, we don't have only one person doing all that driving. But what it's like is you wake up in the morning, usually in a hotel room, and you've looked at the weather the night before and over the last few days. So you have some idea what the atmosphere is doing, some idea where storms may be most likely. And we determine, okay, well, where do we think severe weather is most likely, both today and then tomorrow and then usually the next day? So we plot a route, we drive to where storms are most likely, and ideally we get there an hour or two before storms form. And we call this hurry up and wait, because it's a lot better to sit around a gas station or a truck stop or a McDonald's for a couple of hours and wait for storms to form, then say, hey, look at that storm 150 miles that way. You know, it's really cool. I wish we were there. See you in 2.5 hours.
So when you are out and you're trying to chase a storm, why are you chasing it? And how close do you get to them?
There are several different reasons why people go out and chase storms. Most of my first chases up through from 2004 up through 2010 were in the name of science. We would take the mobile Doppler radars out and other instrumented vehicles out to the storms and get the high resolution, both in time and in space, radar data on these storms to try to determine why some of these rotating supercell thunderstorms produce tornadoes and why some don't. And this culminated in 2009 and 2010 with a project called Vortex 2. That stands for the Verification of the Origin of Rotation in Tornadoes Experiment 2. We're very creative with acronyms in science. And we had 30 to 40 vehicles going around these storms, gathering integrated data sets to hopefully better answer that question. Because if we can, you know what, we'd probably increase the lead time on our tornado warnings. Then beginning in 2011, the science projects had concluded for the time being. I was in my second year here at the U of I, and I said, you know, if you're studying animals and you really want to learn about animals, you'll go to the zoo or you'll go on safari in Africa, or you'll go look at live animals. If you're studying geology and you want to learn about rocks, well, you'll go out to Utah or someplace that has the kind of rocks you want to look at, and you'll go out and look at the rocks. Well, if you want to go look at storms and learn about storms, you'd go out and look at storms. Well, unlike rocks and unlike zoo animals, storms move. They don't always form in the same place. They usually don't. So that is where all the driving comes in.
What's it like to be next to a storm like that?
I'm not going to deny there's an adrenaline rush. Like I said, every storm looks different, and you don't know. You know, you have some idea what the chances of tornadoes might be that day, but you don't know if storm's going to produce a tornado or it doesn't. Last May, we were out in Kansas, and we got a real late start that day. Our van was in the shop. It had a cracked fuel pump. We didn't leave until 2:30 in the afternoon. Fortunately, or somewhere I wanted to be, about an hour and a half away, we drove over there. We watched the storm form. We were standing there watching the storm. It produced a little funnel cloud, and I said, hey, look at that wall cloud over there. It's about 6 miles away. Why don't we get a few miles closer? It looks like it might do something interesting. So we got in the van, we drove north, and as we were driving north, the road was lined with hills and trees. And one thing storm chasers don't like are hills and trees, because they block your view. And we turned off on a side road, came over this hill, and there's this big cone tornado sitting there probably 4 or 5 miles away. And we had no idea it was there, and just feel a rush of excitement. That's one of the things, not the only thing we're looking for. It's not all about tornadoes.
I want to cut in and follow up on something you just said a moment ago, that when you came across and see the trainer, there was this incredible excitement.
Yeah.
Was fear a part of that?
Well, if you're right next to it, if you're not scared, I think there's something wrong with you. But we were 5 or so miles away from this tornado. In this particular tornado, it wasn't moving at us. And it was very unusual. This particular tornado wasn't really moving at all. Which is quite unusual. Most tornadoes move from west to east, or here in Illinois, southwest to northeast. That's not always the case. Like I said, by looking at radar, you know, radar image of the storm, you have some idea where the storm's going. And if you're right up next to it, yeah, that's extremely dangerous. And I know there are some folks who go that close usually to get video, and I think that is extremely dangerous to do, and I would never do that. I do want to point out that there were 4 storm chasers who were fortunately killed last May 31st near Oklahoma City. I saw that storm from behind. We were west of the storm. We had a pretty bad view of the tornado through the rain, but we were behind it. It wasn't moving at us. And 3 of the storm chasers who were killed, their mission was science. It was to put probes or put scientific instruments in the path of the tornado. And you say, well, that sounds pretty easy. The tornado's over here. It's moving this way. Just drop some of these things and get out of there with plenty of time to spare. Well, tornadoes can be very fickle. They can change their path. And most tornadoes aren't that wide. That particular one was over 2 miles wide. But to actually put down something and have the tornado go right over it is a lot more difficult than you think. So their mission required them to get up very close to a tornado, and this tornado ended up being very large and very strong, and there were actually what we call suction vortices or sub-vortices, like miniature tornadoes, rotating around the center of this tornado at over 100 miles an hour. And unfortunately, they were unable to get out of the way of the tornado, and one of those suction vortices did hit their car.
So in part of your role as a clinical professor at the university, mm-hmm. you take out students to go chase storms?
We don't – when you say chase storms, it sounds like you're driving after the storm at breakneck speed. We're not doing that. We go out and we observe storms, or we observe atmospheric convection.
Okay. And do you still worry about what might happen if you guys did make a misjudgment?
Well, the sense of responsibility is ultimately there. I have years of experience in both decision-making and in navigating vehicles to hopefully keep us out of harm's way. And knowing that I'm the leader of the group and basically what I say goes, I'm very, very careful not to do something that would make me uncomfortable. And you follow some basic safety rules. For example, you always try to leave yourself not one but 2 escape routes in paved roads. You don't want to get on a dirt road in the rain. It turns into mud, and especially down in Oklahoma, it's clay. It turns into very, very slick mud, and you can end up in the ditch. You don't put yourself too close. You don't put yourself right in front of the tornado-producing region of the storm. You don't drive up next to a tornado. You stay out of the large hail. All of these things. But the number one danger with any kind of storm observation, be it scientific or educational or otherwise, is just driving that many miles or people next to storms doing stupid things. You talk about distracted driving with people, you know, texting while driving. You don't want to do that. Well, same thing. You don't want to be checking the radar while you're driving. You don't want to be staring at the storm while you're driving. You don't want to not pull all the way off the country road. You know, you don't pull all the way off the road. Someone can hit your car. Basic things like that are actually the most dangerous part.
One of the things I wanted to ask you, as a journalist, I have this weird relationship with breaking news.
Okay.
So when breaking news happens, there's that adrenaline you were talking about, mm-hmm. and it's exciting to be in an environment where you're trying to cover some of those things. But also when breaking news happens, sometimes it's because there's something awful
right.
that has happened.
Right, like the Japanese tsunami or,
right.
you know, war.
So I have this kind of love-hate relationship with stuff like that. Do you feel that way at all about tornadoes? I mean, do you think about the destruction that they're causing when you're out trying to figure them out for science?
Oh, absolutely. I tell, you know, the students before we go out in the field, we have classroom instruction on weather and forecasting and safety and all kinds of things. I say, look, if you're, you know, we're going to lunch at McDonald's in some small town, don't walk around being so excited. Oh, man, there could be big tornadoes today. Wouldn't that be so cool? Well, if that's your farm or your small town, you're not going to be very excited about that. I wasn't very excited to see that forecast for where I lived back on November 17th. And when the tornado's going on, yes, there's, you know, for some folks, that's what they're looking for. Like I said, that's not my one goal. A beautiful storm that doesn't make a tornado can be very, very rewarding to me.
I want to shift gears just a little bit. A lot of the questions that we've had over the years about tornadoes have come from people wanting to know when they're coming so that they can get to safety.
Right.
How reliable is weather prediction technology?
Well,
for tornadoes specifically.
Yeah. Well, it's an interesting question you ask. In terms of looking a couple days out, we generally have a pretty good handle when there's going to be a severe weather or a tornado outbreak a couple days out. For example, the November 17th event, we had forecasted a elevated risk of severe weather for that Sunday, at least 4 days out. The National Weather Service had done that. I remember I was watching the computer models of the atmosphere come in, and it was really that Friday night before the event. I was sitting at home Friday evening watching the models come in, and I said, wow, this looks like it could be a major severe weather event. And that was forecasted Saturday by the Weather Service. And then the new outlook came out late Saturday night, and it was pretty chilling to read, but it read, you know, conditions are favorable for multiple violent long track tornadoes across portions of Illinois and Indiana. And that's exactly what did happen during the late morning and into the early afternoon. But that said, the science is nowhere near where we can say a tornado will hit Gifford on Sunday, a tornado will hit near Villa Grove on Sunday, but a tornado will not hit Champaign-Urbana on Sunday. We can't even do that, you know, a couple hours out.
Why not?
Why not? Well, thunderstorms and tornadoes are very small-scale phenomena. They're not very big. A big tornado is something that's a mile wide. Most tornadoes are, you know, 10, 50 yards wide, somewhere in there. Thunderstorms, the tornado-producing thunderstorms, those supercells are maybe 10 miles across. And the way the atmosphere works is the smaller the things are, the less predictable they are and the shorter they last. You know, something really big like a low-pressure system, you know, the swirl of clouds from a low-pressure system can encompass half the United States. Those things last for days. Okay, the low is over Kansas today. It'll move northeast up into Minnesota tomorrow. We can predict that fairly well. But where exactly will the thunderstorms be spawned, for example, along that cold front? Well, we can't say that.
You're giving a presentation about tornado preparedness this
right.
evening.
Mm-hmm.
What are the most important things in order to be prepared for a tornado?
Right. Okay, well, number one is if a tornado warning is issued, don't wait for the sirens. If you hear a tornado warning issued, seek substantial shelter. That means no mobile homes. That means no cars. Number two is get to the lowest floor of that shelter, okay, preferably a basement, and an interior room. So the idea, again, is put as many walls between the tornado winds that are outside and you as possible. Basements are preferred, but not every house has a basement. For example, my house doesn't have a basement. So a good place to go is a closet or especially an interior bathroom. Why bathrooms? Because the pipes, the metal pipes that run through the walls, well, that's going to provide extra reinforcement to those walls. Another good thing to do is if you're at home, get underneath a mattress or heavy blanket, something that's cushioning but can also offer protection to your head and neck and body. Another real easy tip is if you hear a tornado warning and you're at home or you have it with you, put your bike helmet on. It's designed to protect you from impact if you fall off your bike. So, you know, debris gets blown into your head. It'll help protect you from that. That's a really good thing. And also,
I have never heard that before.
It's something that's we've really only talked about for the last few years. I don't know who thought of it, but it's really ingenious. And even if you don't have a bike helmet, if you're really worried about tornadoes, you can go out to the store and buy one for probably $40 or $50. Another good idea, too, is to put your shoes on, because in the unlikely event you do get hit by a tornado, there's going to be stuff everywhere. Debris, glass, rocks, who knows what. Things you don't want to be stepping on without shoes on.
Jeff, thank you very much for joining me today.
Hey, well, Lindsay, thanks for having me on. It's my pleasure.
I'm Lindsay Moon, and I've been talking this half hour with Jeffrey Frame. He's a storm chaser and a clinical assistant professor of atmospheric science at the University of Illinois. He's giving a presentation this evening about tornado and severe weather preparedness at the Beckman Institute Auditorium in Urbana at 7 o'clock p.m. A detail worth noting, there is free parking available at the U of I parking garage at University in Matthews, right next to the Beckman Center. Tomorrow on the show, Jeff Bossert talks with Michael Auger, a member of the University of Illinois Chess Team and an editor of Chess Life magazine about the world of collegiate chess. You've been listening to Focus on WILL AM 580. Again, I'm Lindsay Moon. Jason Croft is our technical director. Ryan Weber is our intern. Thanks for joining us.